lies, so-called fact-checkers, contentious interviews, and dare I say it, gaslighting. We'll talk about these things and more on today's Principles and Policies. Hi, this is Chuck Michaelis. I'm your host here on Principles and Policies. And gosh, could you maybe think about what I might be talking about today on the day after one of the most contentious interviews I've seen on any kind of news network or television network, and why that may have occurred. Today is my show being recorded for October 19th, 2024, and I'm recording it on the 18th, October 18th, 2024. If my voice sounds a little funny, it's because I'm fighting a cold. So, just keep that in mind. If I sound a little funky, my voice is not in good shape, so I may have to hit the cough button a couple of times while I'm dealing with this issue. Okay, well, folks, I want to start out. I don't want to go directly to the Kamala Harris interview with Bret Baier, but maybe I need to, because that was probably one of the most contentious interviews that I've ever seen. And why was it so contentious? You have to ask yourself. And I was on Mike O'Reilly's show, The Talk of the Town, yesterday morning, on Thursday morning on the 17th. And he asked me several questions that kind of got me going on this situation. Now, I'll be quite honest. Kamala Harris was not able to do what she does best, and that is filibuster. She'll get on, she'll be asked a question, and it'll be a pretty specific and direct question, and what does the person who has asked the question get back? They get back what we have been calling the word salad. And generally, Kamala will answer the question she wanted to be asked, not the question that she was asked. And she's been doing that since not just her ascension to the presidential candidate status that happened this last summer. When Joe Biden wisely pulled out of the race. She's been doing it her entire political career. Now, most of you are only familiar with her as far back as her becoming the vice presidential candidate in 2020. But the fact is that I've heard of her career and sort of watched it from when before she was... the senator from California. Some of you may not know she was the senator from California. Before that, she was the attorney general in California. And her record is, shall we say, not spotless. She was a terrible attorney general from a civil rights aspect. Now, she got plenty of... she claims to be all for recreational marijuana now, but in while she was AG of California, she was putting people away for long, long sentences for marijuana possession. And she was doing things like claiming that she had the right to send agents to knock your door down if you owned a gun and you had once been on an antidepressant drug or some other psychoactive thing. Now, nobody wants anybody that's crazy to have a gun. But somebody who's been on Zoloft and owns a gun and hasn't taken it for 25 years really is not a danger for the most part. I'm sure there are some who are, but for the most part, they aren't a big danger. So... I watched her. She did all kinds of stuff like this while she was AG of California, and she wasn't particularly popular. But here's the sad, ugly truth. California elects. There has not been a Republican in the governorship since Arnold Schwarzenegger, and frankly, he wasn't really a Republican. He was a Democrat in Republicans' clothes, a rhino, if you will. And, you know, he went through the whole thing. I'm not a Kennedy, blah, 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 blah. Well, yeah, he was. He was just as bad as the Kennedys. And was a terrible, frankly, I can still remember Hugh Hewitt. I laugh about this every once in a while. You may have heard it on previous shows. Hugh Hewitt coming on and saying, you're going to love Arnold Schwarzenegger as governor of California. Well, I'm still waiting for that to happen, and he hasn't been governor of California for quite some time. So that's not going to happen. But the fact is that Kamala has always gotten away with, because we currently live in a society where women, especially women of color, cannot be questioned closely for some reason. This is the way that people like Fonnie Willis, who is the prosecutor down in Atlanta, Georgia, who is ginned up a bunch of charges against Trump for election fraud charges. And this case has been going on and on and on and on, and she keeps getting it, big hunks of it, dismissed. And she goes back and she cries and screams and tries to get the Georgia Supreme Court to reinstate them, and they don't do it. So her case is falling apart. But no one has ever sat her down and asked her tough questions. And that's the problem. Who are you going to get to ask her tough questions? The answer is the journalists that she picks to give interviews to are friendly. Now, there's nothing new about this in the American Republic. The fact is that if you go back and study the press during the early part of the American Republic, if you go back and look at it, my gosh, folks, we think things are contentious now. Things are newspapers just saying things that are incredibly scurrilous, accusing people of all kinds of things, of having mistresses and being a thief and all these things. It all happened as far back as George Washington's first term, and actually before that, because remember, the American Republic goes back to 1776. Now, how can I say that? The American Revolution was going on then. Yes, that's right. And we had a sitting government at that time. Each of us, actually, the main part of our government was in the individual colonies, in the 13 colonies. Each colony had a government and was considered to be, each one of the colonies were independent of one another. Okay? They were not run as one big, happy organization. There was no, before the Continental Congress, there really wasn't any unity in, they were rivals for trade. And who controlled the trade? Great Britain did. This is one of the reasons why we got we ended up with a central government. The colonies banded together, formed the Continental Congress to deal with common needs among the colonies, who, as you well aware, July 4th, 1776, if you're not aware of that, that's why we celebrate July 4th. That's Independence Day. What happened? The United Colonies got together and declared independence from Great Britain. And then we fought the war went on till 1783, from 1775, really. The first heartbeat of a revolt was when Massachusetts revolted A lot of people think everything was going on in all the colonies. No, Massachusetts revolted first. That's Lexington and Concord, ladies and gentlemen. If you are unfamiliar with the history, there were battles with the British Army. Battles, not so much skirmishes, more like it, where the British army was sent in by the local commander in Boston, because Boston had become a hotbed of essentially unrest. The decision was made that by the local commander that he was going to send soldiers to seize muskets and gunpowder and artillery pieces that were owned by various cities. Actually, artillery pieces and muskets were very often privately owned and kept in a common storehouse. So the idea was that the British government was going to seize these materials because, for obvious reasons, if the people are armed, you cannot simply run a tyranny. So therefore, the British government, the governor, decided that it was time to seize these arms. So they sent the army out. Well, that's what the whole midnight ride of Paul Revere, who, by the way, did not finished the ride. He was captured. Other people, I think, what was the fellow's name? Charles Dawes. There were three or four people who were out ringing the alarm to awaken the militias, the local militias, to protect their storehouses. And so these skirmishes took place at Lexington, where the British went in and were working to seize that Lexington's commonly held defensive materials, and then again at Concord, where it was actually much more favorable to the colonists at Concord. Okay, going through that, we understand that that ignited the whole thing. But remember, we didn't really have a concerted effort. The Continental Congress sort of came together out of the other colonies realizing what was happening, because the same things were going on in other colonies subsequent to this. And but it went on for a year, over a year, because Lexington and Concord was in April of 1775. And the Continental Congress did not declare independence until July of 1776. So it was about 14 months, 13 months maybe. But that being said, there were no attempts at uniting all the colonies. They were independent. They worked independently. Why do I bring all this up? I bring it up because the United States of America, the United Colonies, each had an existing government during the entirety of the Revolution. What we call the Revolution, really, it was the War for Independence. This wasn't a revolution, per se. We won't go into that. It was a war for independence, and each of the colonies had its own government. They actually acted as a confederation. I know people don't like that word, a confederation of independent republics who were worked together for the purposes of winning independence for each individual colony from Great Britain. That really, after about 1777, what happened? The colonies, through the auspices of the Continental Congress, realized that what they needed to do was form an actual union. Okay, so what did they do? They wrote the Articles of Confederation. The Articles of Confederation is our first constitution. That's our first governing document on a national level. Now, it was written in 1777. It wasn't fully adopted until, I think, right around the time of Yorktown, which was October of 1781. So we were operating under it operationally, but we weren't officially under the Articles of Confederation as a confederated, we were a federal republic, a true federal republic, where we had 13 independent countries who were fighting for their independence from Great Britain, but uniting for specific things under the auspices of the Articles of Confederation. And that's really, if you read the Constitution, that's kind of also what we've done, although it was altered, essentially altered beyond its scope after the war between the states. Again, I don't want to go into that. Why is that important? Well, let's go back to why we first started this discussion on the American Republic. It had to do with the press. Now, go back in the early part of the, and there are books out there that talk about this, the early part of the Republic, the press was absolutely scurrilous. There were no limits, no holds barred, because it was understood that essentially freedom of the press was one of the reasons that we were attempting to break away from Great Britain. Because if you said something mean about the king in a newspaper, sometimes the royal governors would send in soldiers to essentially break up, destroy your printing press, and throw you in jail and try you for treason against the king simply because you said that the king has essentially violated our rights. That's why there's a guarantee. Now, I'm in the middle of a discussion with someone online right now, and it has to do with CBS, who's been caught in numerous lies during this campaign season, and embarrassingly so, but they don't act embarrassed. They don't seem to really care that they've been caught. We'll just go on, move along, nothing to see here. We promise it'll all come together in the end. Well, it won't come together in the end because you're lying. In other words, what we have been calling here on this show, gaslighting, and they are gaslighting, and they've been caught at it numerous times. In fact, we're going to go over an interview here before too long where we see how the gaslighting is done. But that being said, the one of the things the colonies did was make sure that newspapers had a right to freedom of the press. And what does that mean? It means, okay, it doesn't mean you can print pornography. It doesn't mean that you can do things that violate the standard norms of the community. You can't print a bunch of pornographic novels. You can't print pornographic pictures. There are certain things should be done decently. I personally believe that includes not being allowed to curse openly in the street or on television. And by curse, I mean, first of all, there are different kinds of curses. There are blasphemy, in which the name of the Lord God is taken in vain. And we all know we are prohibited from that. Those of us who are Christian understand that we cannot take the name of the Lord God in vain. And taking it in vain means vanity is essentially using it not to directly address and pray to God, but simply use him as a curse. Now, there are legitimate uses for certain terms that we normally think are in vain. There's a great movie, Cromwell, made in the 60s. It's about Oliver Cromwell and the English Revolution in the 1640s. And there is a scene where Cromwell in the Parliament after the king comes in and says something scurrilous about the members of Parliament and threatens to have them all hanged, drawn, and quartered for treason and blah, 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 and says things that are deeply insulting that are beyond his purview. Cromwell, in a scene, uses a common, what normally would be a blasphemy, and The initials are GD. He says, GD, this king. And that, in this case, is not a blasphemy. It is an imprecatory prayer. He is literally asking God to intervene and use his power to bring judgment upon the king. That is a legitimate use of that phrase. If you bang your thumb with a hammer and use that phrase, that is a vanity. Okay? You might say, Lord, would you please take the pain away and help me not to hit my thumb again? That's a legitimate prayer. But saying that other phrase, because you've hit your thumb with a hammer, is not legitimate. It's cursing. Okay. So we've gotten there. So I don't believe that that's allowed to be spoken on the street, and I especially don't believe that that should be allowed in print. Now, would I completely restrict? There are instances where that kind of language can be used to illustrate what shouldn't be said. Like, for instance, in a novel, someone who's evil, who uses that kind of language, can be very illustrative if you're mature enough to be able to handle it and recognize it. That's part of the problem. So I wouldn't ask for a prohibition of that in special circumstances. But, and I also don't agree with the idea of censor boards. I do agree with the idea of people self-censoring. Now, in the early days of the press, they would just say anything. And by anything, I don't mean they would take the Lord's name in vain or anything like that, but they would say horrible things about people that they didn't like politically. Editors of these newspapers and pamphlets and magazines and that kind of thing. But remember, the power of the press was very potent during the Revolution. One of the people who was very important to the colonial cause for independence during the Revolution was a guy named Thomas Paine. Thomas Paine was a master propagandist, and he wrote wonderful stuff. The problem is that Thomas Paine was a radical. And sometimes he wrote stuff that everybody said, oh, way too far, way beyond the pale there, Tom. And Thomas Paine was really he was more of a radical than a revolutionary than someone who necessarily believed in liberty. In other words, he was more of a libertarian who thought individual freedom was more important. When I say individual freedom, the freedom to do anything as an individual. That's essentially modern libertarianism. The complete autonomy of the individual. Okay. Again, let's go back to what was happening in the press. Just horrible things were being said, and mobs would often go around. They'd get mad and go around and bust up a newspaper because horrible things were said about the people that this mob supported, that the newspaper had been critical of. So there's nothing new about a scurrilous press who prints lies, honestly, prints lies. Now, I was talking to you about a contentious back and forth I'm having. And now I want to read to you the First Amendment. And this is the guarantee of several things, not just the what we're focused today, but it's important to understand that these things all kind of run together. First Amendment, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, which doesn't mean what it's been made to mean, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, which means exactly what people say it doesn't mean, or abridging the freedom of speech. That doesn't mean you can go yell fire in a crowded movie house. It doesn't mean that you can go and take a bullhorn and go down to the public square and scream obscenities, as we've just discussed, or of the press. So in other words, the federal government and the state governments, since this is written into virtually all the state government constitutions, or the right of the people to peaceably assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Okay? That's what the problem with the whole January 6th mess is. It started out as a peaceful attempt to redress grievances, and it was turned into a riot, I personally think, by people who were deliberately stirring up the crowd. In fact, if you've heard the recordings, people saying, "We need to go into the Capitol, we need to go in, we need to go in," and it was a specific individual who interestingly was not prosecuted at first, and then later was given a hand slap. The guy who basically told everybody to go into the Capitol, they tried to get him by with nothing. I think he was a Fed. And in fact, so did the crowd, because a lot of people in the crowd started screaming, "Fed, Fed, Fed, Fed," knowing full well that they were probably being gaslighted into going in the Capitol. Now, did they do so? Yeah, unfortunately, they did. And they did stupid things. The guy with the buffalo headdress in the chambers of the House of Representatives and that kind of thing. Okay, was that protected under this? No, it wasn't. Is it also protected to just come out and lie in a newspaper or a magazine or a pamphlet or on network television? The answer is, yeah, that's protected. The discussion I've had with this person, someone came out and said, you know, CBS had been caught in this lie, and these people were angry. And they said, CBS should have its license revoked. And I wrote down, what license? The federal government does not license news gathering organizations. It's specifically prohibited from doing so by the First Amendment. You cannot license people to gather and present news. It's an infringement upon freedom of speech and the press. And I'll go to my dying day saying that news organizations can lie through their teeth as long as someone out there is allowed to call it out and present it as what it is, lies. Now, here's the exchange. Speaker Johnson secretly films interview Margaret Brennan caught lying. And Margaret Brennan works for CBS. All right, here's how it went. So CBS should lose their license. And I said, what license? And somebody said, the FCC, I think. No, the FCC cannot license news gathering organizations. Here's what I said. FCC doesn't and can't, by constitutional prohibition, license network, quote unquote, news organizations. I got a kickback from someone who said the Center for American Rights filed a complaint with the FCC against CBS News over its editing of a Kamala Harris interview answer during her 60 Minutes interview. What should the penalty be for misleading the voting public? And I replied, the real question is, what authority does the FCC have in disciplining a quote-unquote news gathering agency? The Constitution is pretty clear. The right to freedom of the press shall not be infringed. Does this mean they can lie? Sadly, yes. And they do, and they have, and they will continue to do so. The FCC might be able to force in a quote-unquote opinion disclaimer, but the odds of that succeeding a court challenge are similar to the odds that quote-unquote journalists will awaken to their responsibility to be honest and fair. Has never happened, and it never will. That's why I'm going on this particular sidebar. All right, I got a reply that says they have a civil right, meaning the news outlets have a civil right, but the Supreme Court has ruled in the past that the FCC has a duty to protect the limited airwaves in the interest of the American people. A radio or TV station can, in fact, lose their license to use those public airwaves if they do certain bad things. You have a civil right to speak, to use the internet, to print a newspaper in your own building. There is no unlimited right to use the public airwaves. Just imagine all the bad groups that would love to have their own TV station. Yeah, okay, this guy misses the point. Completely misses the point. First, the right to the rights laid out in the Bill of Rights are not civil rights. Civil rights implies that government created them. Government did not create them. They're created by God, and government is stepping in to protect them. This is a big deal. Yes, government has the duty, not just the right, but the duty to protect our God-given rights, not civil rights. Civil rights are simply cooked up by Congress, signed by a president, and enforced by an agency with no real responsibility to the voting public, except every once in a while when they way overstep their bounds, the Supreme Court will slap them down. That's a civil right. That is not a God-given right. Now, where is he wrong on this? He conflates the fact that CBS News gathers news and puts it out to the radio and TV stations. Yeah, because CBS has a radio news affiliate and has a TV news affiliate. Okay, affiliation. He says they can lose their license. A radio station or TV station can lose their license to use those public airwaves if they do certain bad things. Yeah, they can. But that's not CBS. That's the individual station, which some of them are owned by the network and some of them are individually owned. For years, our CBS outlet here in Central Ohio was owned by Wolf Broadcasting, hence WBNS. Wolf Broadcasting News Service was what WBNS stood for. The fact is that Channel 10 was fully owned by the Wolf family, who also owned the Columbus Dispatch. That was pretty common. Now, some of those old things are breaking up, like those of us who are old enough to remember the old WLW network. That was Powell Crosby's network, and it was stations that networked across Ohio and Indiana. It was, let's see, WLWC in Columbus, WLWT in Indianapolis, WLWD in Dayton, and WLW, I think it was just WLW in Cincinnati. And I think there were five stations. Yeah, the memory is fading. Those stations have all been sold off. They're not owned by the same companies anymore. They have different call letters. Same thing with Channel 6 in Columbus. It used to be WTVN. It's no longer. But that being said, can the local TV stations lose their license? Yeah, they can. And generally, would that happen? It has happened. And it's usually happened when somebody in power someplace is unhappy with what they're getting, the kind of grief that they're getting from people who are doing investigative journalism, real, honest-to-goodness investigative journalism, and they go to the FCC and file a complaint, and the FCC says, hey, you can't do that. You can't say that about these people. Why not? Well, it turns out that they've got their donor class, and they've got the power of Congress behind them, and we can do this. And very often, sometimes... yes, local stations can lose their licenses, but CBS News cannot be told what kind of news to gather. That's the whole point. That's the whole point. Now, I haven't replied to this guy yet, and I will, although it's kind of a waste of time. Other people are reading it. This, folks, this is something that Mike O'Reilly and I talked about on Thursday, on Thursday, on Talk of the Town. Why do people do? Why did Kamala Harris agree to go on Fox News, knowing full well it was not going to be a CBS style, NBC style? It was not going to be friendly in that way. It was going to be far more contentious because Fox News has made it clear they're not big Donald Trump fans. Brett Baer, who did the interview with Kamala Harris, is not a big friend of Donald Trump. He doesn't like Donald Trump, but he is a fair-minded journalist. He says if Donald Trump's going to get brought in and raked over the coals, which I think he did earlier on, he brought him in, raked him over the coals, then Kamala Harris has to come in and get raked over the coals too. Now, she didn't have to come in to Fox News. She could have hooked up with CBS, NBC, ABC, PBS, name it, CNN especially, whose reaction, by the way, to the we might get to that, whose reaction to the interview with Brett Baer is absolutely humorous. And who's back? It's Brian Stelter. Mr. Potato Head is back, making ridiculous commentary. But we can see how it's done. I've got queued up is Speaker Johnson secretly films interview Margaret Brennan caught lying. Yeah, of course she's caught lying. They all lie. Why? Because they have an agenda in mind. They have a worldview they're trying to push off on the viewing public. And if you're kind of a passive person, you'll sit there and go, well, gosh, I just saw Speaker Johnson say this when he didn't say that at all. What he actually said was something entirely different. So I want to play the, this is from Town Hall, and I want to play, what was said and done in this interview with, Margaret Brennan and Speaker Johnson, and who wisely look, if you're going to be recorded by the news media, they show up with a camera for whatever reason, record them as well. And they'll tell you, well, you don't need to do that because we'll have it all on tape. No, no, no. Make your own tape. Believe me. Make your own recording. This is why people... will very often film traffic stops, much to the chagrin of the police. Why? Because they don't get away with as much. I understand the police, but there are bad cops out there, and they don't like being filmed because they know what can happen. They can be suspended, they can be fired, they can lose their jobs, they can be sued. Not so easy to sue CBS News. They got lots of lawyers, they got lots of money, and you don't. So what you do is you plead your case in the court of public opinion. That's just the way it's done. Okay, I want to go over this, so I'll cue it up. This is a guy named Larry. He's at Town Hall, and he's going to open up with a little editorial statement, and I'm going to let it stand, and we'll interact with this as we go along. Here's Larry speaking.
Now, you can call it a lot of things. I know what you can't call that. That's not the business of news. It's the business of activism. It's the business of propaganda. CBS News lies. We know they lie. We caught them lying. Well, really, that incredible Twitter account, Maze Moore, caught them lying. He did the site, or she. Do we know yet if Maze is a he or she? Did a side-by-side comparison of the original 60 Minutes clip of an interview that they did with Kamala Harris showing a nonsensical word salad answer about Benjamin Netanyahu, then showed the highly edited, deceptively edited clip that ended up airing. Stephen Miller, who writes about the media over at Spectator, actually did a further breakdown on multiple edits that occurred during the 60 Minutes program where CBS News did what they could to make Kamala Harris look more intelligent, less.
That's not what we're going to do here. That's not that interview. This is a different interview, but that is what started this ball rolling.
Moronic, more coherent, aiding her performance on their show by deceptively editing it. And they've been asked, they've been...
Okay, that statement is exactly true. They are aiding, in other words, they are acting as campaign operatives for Kamala Harris by aiding her by changing her answer. Now, does she mind that? No. Why? Because it's in her favor. But what you're going to see is an attempt to change an answer, but it's not in support of the Speaker Mike Johnson.
Called on to release the original transcripts and the original videos, and CBS News refuses to do it. We know that's going on, but what just occurred on Sunday with Speaker of the House Mike Johnson may be the final nail in the coffin of anything left of CBS News's journalistic integrity, if they have any. Take a look at this. Mike Johnson appeared on Face the Nation. That's Maureen Brennan, right? She's the woman who was the co-moderator of the J.D. Vance debate. You remember, she tried to jump in and fact-check J.D. Vance, even though there weren't supposed to be any fact-checks. And when J.D. Vance actually started telling the truth about illegal immigration under Kamala Harris, they cut off his microphone by pushing a button under the desk. Yeah, same woman. Well, she interviewed Mike Johnson, but Mike Johnson, Speaker of the House, Republican, he was prepared. On the left-hand side of your screen, you're going to see what CBS showed their viewers. On the right side of the screen is going to be a video that Mike Johnson set up in the studio that he recorded himself to show what his complete answers were. Take a look at this.
So that's a different accounting than this 2% you say was distributed.
Yeah, so they've obligated some funds, but they've only distributed 2%. The rescue and recovery effort's still going on, and then we address the rest of it.
So that's a different accounting than this 2% you say was distributed.
Yeah, so they've obligated some funds, but they've only distributed 2%. And when I was there on the ground, and you should go, I mean, bring the cameras and talk to the people there. They'll tell you, don't take politicians' words for this or the administration's word. Talk to the people there on the ground. They had not been provided the resources almost 2 weeks out from the storm that they desperately needed. And when I was there 13 days post the storm hitting that state, people are still being rescued. They're stuck in the higher elevations in the mountains because the roads are down and all the rest. So they need every available resource and all hands on deck. The rescue and recovery effort's still going on. And then we address the rest of it.
Wow. Now,
okay. Those were clearly not the same answer. Clearly not. Entirely different focus on the answer. This is what journalists do, quote unquote journalists do, when they have a political axe to grind. They will take a statement that they've recorded, and a lot of times people aren't smart enough to record their own. They take a statement that's been recorded, and they will make it say something not necessarily entirely different, but cut out all the nuances and the state, you know, everything that the speaker who was asking, answering a question that was asked of him, and by the way, a rather contentious manner, tried to make it say something that he did not say.
So that's really telling, not just that they edited so much out of the final show the final presentation of Face the Nation, but what they edited. Mike Johnson was specifically talking about the real circumstances on the ground in North Carolina from Hurricane Helene, saying, I was just there. I talked to people. They said they haven't seen anyone. They haven't gotten any kind of federal response. Bring your camera, show them, talk to them. CBS News didn't want their viewers to see or hear any of that. Gee, I wonder why. Now, understand, this happens a lot in terms of politicians going and pre-recording interviews for these Sunday shows. Sometimes it's earlier in the morning. Sometimes it's the day before. And then they're sort of at the mercy of the network to edit out their own answers to the questions. Mike Johnson was smart. He was prepared. And he made these videos so that you can see the two side by side. Here's another example.
You know that it is against the law for non-citizens to vote in federal elections. That's established law.
Of course it is. Of course it is. But of course it is. But here's the problem. There's a number of states that are not requiring proof of citizenship when illegals or non-citizens register to vote. We know that's happening.
But respectfully, Speaker,
everybody should want the law to be followed.
You know that it is against the law for non-citizens to vote in federal elections. That's established law.
Of course it is. Of course it is. But of course it is, but here's the problem. There's a number of states that are not requiring proof of citizenship when illegals or non-citizens register to vote. We know that's happening. Look, Glenn Youngkin in Virginia, I was going to say, he issued an executive order to clean up the voting rolls heading into the election. Less than 30 days out, a couple of days ago, the Biden administration, Department of Justice, Biden-Harris administration, sued the governor and the Commonwealth of Virginia to try to prevent them from cleaning up their voter rolls. See, that kind of thing creates a lot of doubt and concern in the minds of a lot of the American people. Why would they do that? Everybody should want the law to be followed.
Interesting.
Not the same answer, was it? Those two answers side by side, not the same answer. The first recording made CBS look good, made the Margaret Brennan look good, but the second answer made her look bad. Why? Because Mike Johnson had the facts, and she did not. She's just standing on a soapbox and saying, "Hey, we all know it's illegal it's against the law for illegals to vote." When the government refuses to actually enforce the law, it's no longer illegal. This is sort of like in Chicago in the 20s. Did the mobs make and sell beer and gin and all kinds of alcoholic beverages? The answer is yes. Was there an enforcement operation? Well, sort of. The local governments very often knew where all the breweries were, where all the distilleries were, and the fact that places, Al Capone was importing and trucking across country. Stuff was coming in Detroit and going to over to Chicago. In those days, you didn't hop on a freeway. You were on some rough roads, but yeah, they were bringing in liquor from Canada. Okay. Was there an enforcement? So the answer is no. And what does that mean? That means the law is null and void. This is an interview between Sean Hannity, who frankly I don't like very much, and Bret Baier, on the interview in which Baier is going to explain what his thinking was, why he needed to interrupt Kamala Harris's attempts at word salad. And this is a pretty good explanation of why things were done the way they were. And by the way, the interrupting gave the left side of the aisle something to complain about. He wouldn't let her answer the questions. Well, that's because Kamala doesn't answer questions. When she doesn't like the question, she answers something else. And she does it by this word salad method that we've talked about. It just talks and talks and talks and talks and talks and talks. And after, you know, 2 or 3 minutes, you realize that you're talking about something entirely different. So he's going to explain this. Here's Sean Hannity interviewing Bret Baier.
He's our very own. He's the host of Special Report. I think he took all the joy out of the Kamala Harris campaign today. She didn't look particularly joyous doing this interview, but I thought you did a great job with a very limited amount of time. And I just want to take us behind the scenes. What was going on?
Yeah, obviously. Thanks, Sean. It's great to see you. It was a little tense. We were given the time of 5 p.m. Eastern time. Obviously, my show is at 6 p.m. They wanted to tape at 5 p.m. We said we were going to tape as live. In other words, roll the tape and then just turn that around unedited, uninterrupted. But we had to do it before 5:15. Otherwise, we couldn't turn the whole machine around before the top of the 6 p.m. show. So we were waiting at 4:55 and then 5 and then 5:05 and then 5:10. At 5:17, the vice president walked out. So it did feel a little bit like they're icing the kicker or trying to. And originally they were talking about 25.
Okay, icing the kicker. You may not understand what that means, especially the women out there who aren't big sports fans, the men who aren't big sports fans. I know what it means. I'm not a huge sports fan. It means that when you've got a game-ending situation where there's almost no time left on the clock and you've got a kicker lining up for what could be a game-winning field goal, what's the first thing you do? Yeah, you get them lined up. and get them ready, almost so they're ready to snap the ball and call timeout. So the kicker has to think about it for another, for whatever the timeout period is. So he has to think about it a little more. And if you got more than one timeout left, you can timeout, and timeout. So it's a psychological method. Were they icing? Was she icing the kicker? Of course she was. This was her attempt to be in control of the interview, not have the interviewer in control of the interview.
5 minutes, and they gave us 20 minutes, and I was fine with any time. I was really happy to get the interview. But I knew right away when we started asking questions, that this was kind of a sense that she was going to keep on talking, and that if I wanted to get through and redirect, I was going to have to interrupt. I don't particularly love to do that, but if I didn't do it, there may have been, you know, four answers in the interview.
This is what's called filibustering. If you've heard the term, filibustering is an old nautical term. It has to do with pirates. But what he means by that is she talks and doesn't allow him to ask any more questions. So he was worried they'd reduce the amount of time down to 20 minutes and she was going to control the interview by talking. And he said, this is him saying, I wasn't going to allow that.
Well, I don't really think he had any choice. And for people that don't understand the time in TV, if somebody's trying to filibuster or avoiding a direct question, which you did repeatedly, or just going off and using that moment or every moment to attack her opponent, as I think she did often in this, what I did like about what you did, I'm guessing you probably had 50 questions in your arsenal that you were ready to ask, questions you would have loved to have gotten to.
Yeah,
I'm guessing.
75.
But what I noticed.
Yeah, 75 questions he had for a basic what amounts to a half hour interview. He had some serious questions to ask, and she had to have known. Why did this woman choose to come on Fox News? She's in electoral trouble. She thought she could recover by coming in and controlling an interview with Bret Baier and basically getting at the Fox News audience, which is not the same as the CNN audience, not the same as the CBS audience, not the same as the ABC, blah, blah, blah. They're not the same people. One thing I told Mike O'Reilly on Thursday morning is the sad part about this, she performs so badly in this interview. And if you haven't seen it, go out to YouTube. You can find the whole interview. Go out, watch it, see how badly she performs to the point where at the end of the interview, she is literally waving her arms and yelling. Now, she's not screaming at the top of her lungs, but her voice is raised. It's shrill. She's clearly upset because she has not been able to control the interview. Okay? That's an important consideration. She thought she was going to make a big impression on the Fox News audience, who tends to be kind of middle of the road. A lot of the conservatives left and went over to places like One American News and other places to get news. After the 2020 campaign when Fox News essentially worked to sabotage Donald Trump. And they've since, broomed out a number of their conservative voices. They still have people. Sean Hannity, I guess, is considered a conservative voice. Whatever. But in any case, let's go on.
And I think you had to do is, for example, you did spend a significant amount of time on immigration. Now, I played a lot of tape at the beginning of this show. She wants to decriminalize illegal immigration. She said it in her own words. She wants free housing, health care, education, sex change surgeries. She's on tape saying it. You brought up Tim Walz's position, driver's licenses, free college, a path to citizenship, amnesty. They rescinded all of the Trump and they said it proudly, all of the Trump policies that were working. Trump's chart that he loves so much shows that. That's the chart that saved his life in Butler, PA. And she just denied it and wouldn't answer. And I was more shocked at her lack of apology to people that died by these unvetted illegal immigrants that came in because of their policies.
Yeah. So I studied how she's answered immigration before, and it really does go through a TikTok. You know, she says when they first arrive in office, they put forward this bill and it didn't go through. But she doesn't talk about the bill. It was an amnesty bill for 11 million illegal aliens inside the country over 8 years. They had control of the White House, the Senate, and the House, and yet the Democratic leadership didn't put that bill forward, and the White House really didn't even push it. But she starts there, and then she says there's this evolution. She tried to do all these things with the president, and then they had this comprehensive effort, this bipartisan bill. The bipartisan bill was voted against by 8 Democrats, and it had some major problems that conservatives didn't like. There were about 1.8 million illegal immigrants that would be let in every year. And there were all kinds of other stipulations that conservatives didn't like. So it didn't have a chance. She says that these things happened very quickly. The one bill and the other bill, there were 3.5 years in between them. And in that time, 94 executive orders were rescinded, among them catch and release and remain in Mexico. And that's why a lot of these people were released. It's, you know, there's different numbers, but if you go by the Homeland Security Secretary, 85% of the apprehensions, it's more than 6 million people. And some of them committed heinous crimes. And that's why I wanted to go down that road at the beginning. And I spent a lot of time on it, but I thought nobody else would go into that depth, and I figured it was worth it.
And that's the point. Nobody else would go into that depth. Kamala Harris has not had a difficult interview her entire candidacy for president. In fact, she wouldn't sit down for interviews for months. And that now, because the numbers are turning around badly for her, she now sits for interviews. Folks, this is a form of gaslighting. You decide to go on a place that where you know you're not going to be among friends. Now, again, I say Bret Baier. I have no idea who Bret Baier is going to vote for, who he would support for president, who he would support for the Senate, anything. I have no idea. I have a feeling he's liberal. I don't know. That's what a journalist is supposed to be. Now, I've seen him tear, like I said, tear into Donald Trump, but that's not hard. Because Donald Trump, I will be quite upfront. Do I support him for president? Yes. Personally, do I like him? No, I don't. I think he has a repugnant personality. But I also think that he has the skills and the necessary ability and the mindset to fix major problems in this country. Can he get it done in 4 years? No, he cannot. And we really thought he was going to drain the swamp between 2016 and 2017 and 2021, and he couldn't get it done. Why? Because he didn't understand how the system worked. He did not understand that it was chock full of people who are long-term government operatives, who have an agenda, who are willing to tell the president no when he asked for data. Like, for instance, well, we can't go into that because I'm out of time. But you get the idea of what I'm... I wanted to show you how gaslighting is done, and this was it. These two interviews, the way it's done, and I would suggest, I really wanted to talk about issue one. I'll get that next week. I am out of time, and I would like to hear from you. I mean, you know what I think. I want to know what you think. Now, again, my website is currently down. I'm trying to figure out why. It's one of those things. I'm probably going to have to hire somebody. But my website is down. I know You know what I think. I want to know what you think. And contact me at chairman@principledpolicy.com. That's chairman@principledpolicy.com. That is my email address, chairman@principledpolicy.com. And you can say all kinds of things to me. I have a thick skin. I can take it. But I do want to know what you think. And I would ask that you would join me again next week for another Principles and Policies.